Today on Wings, three leading women experts discuss a side of war that is seldom mentioned in the press or in protests, the military's effects on climate change.
War can start from climate change environment issues, and war will affect this climate change. So it's like a cycle.
There is no internationally agreed framework for measuring and reporting emissions from conflicts.
When the United States tells its NATO allies to increase their military spending up to more than 2% of their GDP, their gross domestic product, those countries' emissions will increase.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
On May 29, 2024, Wings attended an online press briefing titled War and Climate Change, hosted by Covering Climate Now, a collaboration of Columbia Journalism Review, The Nation, and The Guardian. Here are excerpts from the testimonies at that one-hour event.
Thank you so much for the invitation to be here. It's really fantastic to see Covering Climate Now highlighting the importance of this intersection between war and climate change.
Ellie Kinney is a campaign coordinator for the Conflict and Environment Observatory. The UK-based non-governmental organization monitors and raises awareness of the environmental dimensions of armed conflicts and military activities.
So the project is tasked with calculating the carbon emissions of the European Union's militaries. And what we found was that this was actually a lot harder than we thought it would be, because there's shockingly little data. We noticed that there was a gap in military emissions reporting, and we coined the term military emissions gap. But simply put, it's the sort of gap between what militaries report and the actual levels of pollution.
Among Ellie Kinney's duties with the Conflict and Environment Observatory is to follow the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, known as UNFCC, and to attend the conferences of parties, or COPs, at which modifications of that agreement take place. Ellie Kinney.
Briefly, this can be split into three parts. The first part of this gap is what governments are obliged to report to the UNFCCC. No country has to report their military emissions to the UNFCCC. Different countries have different reporting obligations, but not a single one of those includes mandatory emissions from military activity. And interestingly, this also links back to the US. So before the Paris Agreement, when we had the Kyoto Protocol, it was the US who lobbied for militaries to be exempt from reporting, and successful in that. With the creation of the Paris Agreement, this language changed from exempt to voluntary reporting. But we know that if something's voluntary, it doesn't particularly happen, or it doesn't happen particularly well. And that's kind of the second part of the gap, which is how countries report. Because it's voluntary, they just don't tend to do it very well. They often don't disaggregate military data from civilian data, which makes it quite difficult to pull out information that we might need for like research. And then the third part of this is the big one. It's what they don't report at all. Emissions data that is voluntarily reported tends to be things like energy use at bases or maybe fuel use from equipment, but the military emissions are so much more than this. And the biggest absence of that is the military supply chain and this arms industry propped up by creating products for governments. And then another part of what isn't reported is, as we've said, the kind of the lack of reporting framework for conflict emissions. So when we set up the Military Emissions Gap Project, we set up militaryemissions.org, which brings together the data that governments do report into one place. We analyse this against what we do know about militaries to estimate how big we think different countries' emissions gaps are. And we update this every year with UNFCCC data, and we add in whatever bits of reporting we can find and use this as a basis to advocate for thorough and transparent military emissions reporting. Because on a broader level, the project is a campaign. We work across civil society, academia, even with militaries, to really highlight the scale of the problem and to demand action on the UNFCCC level and on national levels, ultimately to make militaries accountable for their contribution to the climate crisis and the situation we're now in. When we talk about the environmental and the climate consequences of a conflict, this isn't to take away from the immediate human suffering, which, I mean, at a time like now is shockingly visible. But it is important that we're able to analyse the full range of impacts that a war has, and that includes environmental destruction and climate damage, as it includes impacts on human rights, women's rights, healthcare, and impacts on like youth and children, for example. So what I hope we'll kind of leave this briefing with is a better understanding of how the humanitarian impacts are intrinsically linked to the environmental and climate damage, and how war and climate change are not simply these two separate issues, whether that's because of the way that emissions directly are caused by wars or by increasing military spending, or whether it's the impact that war has on an area's ability to mitigate and adapt to the climate crisis. And definitely at the moment, I think, as we face these multiple large-scale wars and record-breaking temperatures, journalists really do play a key role in exploring these connections between these existential threats. So I'm really grateful that we've got a chance to dig into this today. So colleagues of mine have produced a range of reports on the environmental impacts of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and this was done in partnership with Soy Environment Network and with the UN Environment Programme. And there's a host of reports. They cover topics like nature, like coastal and marine environments, like industry and nuclear and radiation risks, but it also covers climate change. And I guess the most direct way that we can look at this is the impact on global emissions. Now, it's important that there is no internationally agreed framework for measuring and reporting emissions from conflicts, which means that researchers have had to kind of start from scratch and build this methodology, like researchers have done at the Initiative on Greenhouse Gas Accounting of War. They've developed a framework and they've used this to monitor the war in Ukraine. And their latest estimation is that the first 18 months have resulted in emissions equivalent to the annual output of an industrialized country like Belgium, which is a really significant amount to be taken from our global carbon budget. And this is something that we explore within our reports as well. So the estimation covers things like fuel consumption from both sides of the military, as well as other factors like the way that closed airspace has led to the rerouting of flights. And another huge consideration in this is reconstruction. Reconstruction is hugely carbon intensive. This is visible in Ukraine, and it's also notable in the estimations of the impact of Israel's bombardment of Gaza at the moment too. The majority of emissions caused by a war will come from this kind of destruction and reconstruction of urban areas and infrastructure, which means that as well, a green recovery is really key, but that's definitely not a given unless given financial backing and the resources to do so. When we look at emissions more widely, you may see reductions in other sectors like the drop in the iron and steel sector in Ukraine, but it's quite likely that these moved abroad rather than missing from global emissions. And then within the war specifically, certain incidents will cause spikes, like, for example, the attacks on the Nord Stream pipeline. So the UNEP analysis suggests that the amount of methane that was leaked from this, it represents, I think, less than 0.1% of the sort of annual human-made methane emissions, but it's still a significant quantity of methane, which is a greater contributor to the climate crisis than if it was burnt to release CO2. And this is an incident that's specifically caused by the war. You can also look at the way that the mitigation, adaptation efforts have been impacted. So, like, for example, the numerous renewable energy facilities that have been damaged, I suppose most notably the Kakhovka Dam, and the loss of hydropower capacity that comes with that, but also the destruction of kind of solar and wind farms across the southeast of the country. A lot of what we advocate for is directly to change the UNFCCC's reporting framework to undo a lot of the damage that the US did back in Kyoto and then kind of the way that that was kept in a little bit in the Paris Agreement, and bring the military in under the same amount of accountability that other sectors have within the UNFCCC. It's not an easy task. The UNFCCC is huge, but there is absolutely an effort on this at the moment that we're part of, that lots of other organisations are part of, about recognising the interconnected nature between war and the climate crisis, and not just war, but militarism overall.
That was Ellie Kinney, military emissions campaigner for the Conflict and Environment Observatory.
The way that renewable energy works is often local grids and local production. Centralized production, such as nuclear power plants and large coal and oil burning or natural gas burning plants, are targeted much more easily than something that's more distributed. So yes, militaries like to target the industrial production of energy, but these local grids and local production are much less vulnerable in a sense, because it's just much more difficult to find them.
Dr. Nita C. Crawford is a political science professor at the University of Oxford. She served on the governing board of the United Nations Academic Council. Her most recent book, published by MIT Press, is titled The Pentagon, Climate Change and War, Charting the Rise and Fall of U.S. Military Emissions. Nita Crawford.
The major impetus for the U.S. military decreasing its emissions have been operational and installation changes. They don't talk about it as being concerned about their greenhouse gas impact until really the Biden administration, when that's become much more front and center. U.S. military emissions are the largest emissions from a country. It's the world's largest military spender, 38 to 40% of total global military spending, larger than its major adversaries combined. And its emissions come from both its operations, that is training and war, and its installations. More than 700 bases that the United States has around the world also contribute to emissions. Add up installations and operations, it's the United States' single largest energy user, and therefore the United States' single largest institutional emitter. And you can also think about it in terms of share of GDP or share of the entire economy. It's about 1%. But then you also have to include military industrial emissions. And then when you do that, you need to double that number approximately. Now, I can give you numbers that are exact for operations and installations. I can't give you exact numbers for military industry. That's an estimate. We need better accounting of that. Now, aircraft are extremely thirsty. We're talking gallons per mile, not miles per gallon. Thousands of liters, if you want to use the other system, thousands of liters per hour are consumed by aircraft. So the B-52, many thousands of liters, a smaller aircraft, less. But it's, if you look across the armed services of the United States, it's aircraft. There's a certain amount in terms of other operational emissions that they don't know. It's called unknown. They can't keep track of that fuel use, but the major lion's share of it is aircraft for every service. Now, the U.S. has bases all over the world, in part to ensure access to fuel. It's to protect access to the flow of petroleum in the Persian Gulf or elsewhere, let's say in the Straits of Malacca. But as the United States decreases the amount of oil that it's getting from the Persian Gulf, it has not significantly decreased the legacy military forces that it has ready to deploy to defend that oil. Oil that is decreasingly needed and also shouldn't be burned. So we've got a little mismatch between doctrine and what the world needs right now.
Dr. Nita C. Crawford is a political science professor at the University of Oxford. On Wings, you're listening to presenters from a press conference on war and climate change.
I think 10 years ago, if you talk to journalists, they would prefer working on political, follow the money, and climate will come next or third. Now it's much bigger because ordinary people notice the effects and the impact of climate change on their lives.
Rawan Daman is Director General of Arab Reporters for Investigative Journalism, based in Amman, Jordan. She was previously a senior editor at Al Jazeera for 10 years, commissioning documentaries from across the Arab world. At Arab Reporters for Investigative Journalism, she has opened a regional platform for fact-checkers, created an Arabic platform for whistleblowers, and led the publication of hundreds of investigations. Rawan Daman.
What we used to tell ordinary people, they would think that this is only scientists or it's a long-term thing, maybe 100 years from now it will happen, is happening. And so they noticed the effect of this on soil, land, air, water, even in temperature. So I think this also affected politicians in giving more importance of this. And so journalists became more aware of this. But it's very, very difficult nowadays with what's happening in Gaza and the war in Gaza, with more than 34,000 people killed and more than 77,000 people injured in a very tiny place that is Gaza Strip in Palestine, to convince journalists in Gaza and in Palestine to give climate change story that's necessary. I think especially that Israel refused to get any journalist into Gaza to cover what's happening. People from outside understood that they need, and there is a lot of ways through satellite images, videos, pictures, testimonies from people on the ground, testimonies from UN agencies, to really understand very clearly after 8 months of an ongoing war that we don't know when it will end, that the impact will be very long. Let's imagine that today the ceasefire happens and the war stops. The impact in Gaza on both land, soil, air, water, Gaza is no longer a livable place to live in. So I think this will also affect inside the bodies of the alive people, you know, the grieving, the trauma, and at the same time have, you know, polluted water, polluted food, serious problems with the air and the pollution there, the Mediterranean. I think people forget that Gaza is on the coastal Mediterranean side, and that this is affecting even Israel and even all the Mediterranean. So it's very difficult for me, people not understanding the importance of climate story, because it affects not only one place where it is, but this travels in the water or the sea, in the air. It's happening now as we are speaking. And there is little, I think, coverage of the importance of the long-term impact that this ecocide happening in Gaza will stay with us forever. I'm very worried that people will never be able to go back and live in their houses and places. I remember Gaza. I visited Gaza. I'm Jordanian from Palestinian originally, and I remember the greenhouses in Gaza. I remember how they used to plant in this very tiny place. Now, almost one third of those greenhouses have been destroyed, and there is a clear evidence that it's systematic. The bombardment from the sky, then the Israeli tanks and troops come and uproot the trees, the greenhouses, the farms. It's not only we are losing friends, relatives, people whom we had dinner with, had coffee with, have been killed and lost many of them, but the whole ecosystem of the place is being lost in front of our eyes. I'm afraid we are seeing something that we have never seen like before, even in Syria, Yemen, and Iraq, because this is a very, very tiny place, and it's so difficult to imagine how to do this better in the future.
Rawan Daman is Director General of Arab Reporters for Investigative Journalism, based in Amman, Jordan.
We have been in the region for 17 years, working in all Arab countries in Middle East and North Africa. One of the stories we did in Yemen is on the fishermen and the war in Yemen and the effect of that on the fishing catches, how the decline happened with the climate change. Unfortunately, when the war happens, many things are affected by the war and also neglected because of the war. And this is one of the stories that one of our journalists did in Yemen. There's also a story we did a few years back on Syria and the green forests in Idlib, how killing the trees is another victim of the war in Syria. Also, people, when they have no fuel due to the war, they themselves cut the woods of the forest. When we adopt any story, we are a small, you know, foundation. We are not a publishing platform, so we publish with many independent publishing platforms across the Arab region. The journalists pitch the idea. If it is a good idea, we coach this journalist. We spend 6 months to 1 year sometimes working on this story. Then we have, you know, a process of fact-checking, legal screening. Every Arab country have a different legal screening. We need a lawyer from that country. Then most of those journalists, freelancers, find a publishing platform. We produce in Arabic language and we translate some of the stories into English. Stories from Yemen, Libya, Iraq, Palestine have documented that people would say there's no enough data. No, there is data, and you can calculate data. There is many creative ways of calculating the data and do the estimations rather than saying there's no data covering those stories. We did in one of the stories comparison for the water in Palestine, Israel, between the West Bank and the Israeli settlers. We have in Arij this data diploma where we train journalists for 6 months, and they did very interesting stories on how Israelis enjoy Palestinian water and at the same time they sell to the Palestinians the polluted mineral water. So it's like any other story. You need to bring all the parties. You need to start with your hypothesis and expose the wrongdoing of any party. And that's what all journalism is about. I've been a journalist for 25 years, and it's doable to do this. It's always understandable that when there is, you know, victims, our hearts are with the victims, whomever they are. But it's extremely important. Sometimes the victims are the wrongdoers themselves. And during the war, it's extremely important to explain what's happening and also be very clear what you don't know. We publish many stories in investigations, and there is a gap. There's something we don't know. There's something, there is a question mark. And let's be very clear with the audience and say, we tried to do this, we tried to achieve this, but we were not able to do that. Also, it's extremely important that we are very careful about the vocabulary we use. So we say that it's investigated as a possible war crime or as a possible genocide. And it's very clear, like under the Rome Statute, which governs the International Criminal Court, it's a war crime to intentionally launch an excessive attack, knowing that it will cause widespread, long-term and severe damage to the natural environment. The Geneva Conventions, all of them require that warring parties don't use methods of warfare that cause widespread, long-term, severe damage to the nature environment. So we can use the legal terms very clearly, ecocide and genocide and war crimes, and be very specific about the words we use. Also, visualization is extremely important, especially for ordinary audience. Many are getting only the visualization through the social media and then going to read the full investigation or the full data story. So visualization is extremely important, but it's very important to be fit to what you want to say. Even in visualization, you can lie. There is visualization where you can have the less important thing more important than the more important thing. So it's an editorial / design way of doing this. I would recommend the same journalist to play around different tools of visualization and also use some very simple AI tools, most of them free or very cheap. And at the beginning, play yourself as a journalist, and then work with a specialized designer to get something that's really important. I think people nowadays, especially on social media, they want the quick things. So grab their attention with the visualization so they can come and read the full story in details. I'm usually a very optimistic person, but since October 7th, I've been very pessimistic. The reconstruction itself of Gaza, of course, it was partial in 2008, 2012, 2014, was also a climate problem. The emissions, the rebuilding is also similar to the war, you know, of a climate crisis. I cannot see that there will be a rebuilding this time in Gaza, because the situation of the systematic bombardment have been to making it unlivable. So I don't really see how it will be a rebuilding. The rebuilding with the blockade and the occupation and the closure Israel is putting has been done before partially and has been very problematic, even for, you know, the waste, the water, the pumps, all of this, all of the infrastructure in Gaza have been bombarded, all the hospitals, the schools, the universities. It has never been something like this before.
That was Rawan Daman, Director General of Arab Reporters for Investigative Journalism. You heard excerpts from an online press briefing titled War and Climate Change. The speakers were political scientist Dr. Nita Crawford, the Director General of Arab Reporters for Investigative Journalism, Rawan Daman, and Campaign Coordinator for the Conflict and Environment Observatory, Ellie Kinney. The event was hosted by Covering Climate Now, a collaboration of Columbia Journalism Review, The Nation, and The Guardian. The event was moderated by Giles Trendle, co-chair of CC Now's steering committee and former managing director of Al Jazeera English.
Giles, also there is a question from Firas on how to convince or encourage the journalists on the ground in the war to cover climate. I think the most important is how to get journalists to understand Nita's books, Eli's research, understand how to analyze this, get them to the capacity building, then they choose their priorities, connecting climate stories to their priorities, but with one prerequisite of a full comprehensive safety model. And that's a very problematic thing in the region. In Arij, we have a very comprehensive safety model of physical safety, digital safety, mental safety, legal safety, and career safety. If you are a journalist and you want to continue working on climate change in Yemen, as a freelancer, what is even the career safety channel you will go through? And many of them end up publishing in anonymous names. I think maybe we are the only region where we have fact checkers publishing anonymously. Even in Latin America, Africa, East Asia, we don't have fact checkers working anonymously, but in the Middle East and North Africa, we do. So I think it's extremely important to have the safety model, have the skills, have the knowledge, and then the journalist will come up with the stories that are very relevant to their communities. In the last 5 years, I've been heading Arij, the only case where we had a journalist fired from her work as a full-timer was due to a climate change story, was not due to follow the money or big political story. So unfortunately, climate change wrongdoing is connected with businessmen, with politicians, with the army, with big wrongdoers in the region. And so the risks are high. Therefore, the safety model needs to be very strong, and we encourage journalists to publish anonymously, unfortunately.
Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose recent events can be viewed at .org. That's all one word, maternal gift economy movement .org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.